I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Rabona Podcast. This week, we're talking Nations League, International Friendlies, and also a new feature, Rabona Rewinds, where me, Michael and Ryan will be looking back on our favourite moments in football history. So, Michael, Ryan, welcome again.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you guys doing? Good week?
Very good.
Solid.
Start of the Nations League.
Yes, yes.
What could be any better?
How are you feeling about it, guys? How are you feeling about it?
I have no idea what's going on. Like, what is it? I mean, I think it's good. I think it's good that European teams play other European teams of a similar level. I think that increases competitiveness. And you could see, I think, in some of the games that it seems to mean a bit more now. So that's a nice thing.
Yeah, the atmospheres were much better, I thought.
Yeah.
I watched Georgia. Who did Georgia play? Georgia-Latvia.
Okay.
Georgia, top of their group, by the way, 2 out of 2. And the atmosphere was insane. Like, properly crazy. It was so loud. It was probably the loudest I've seen an international game for a while.
Yeah, whereas I don't think Georgia fans would create that kind of atmosphere for, say...
If it was a friendly against Latvia.
Yeah, or against a big team where they knew they're going to lose.
Yeah. Like you say, the games mean more, and I think it adds a little extra spice.
Isn't
it
a bit like when you're just playing with your mates, like seven aside in the park, and someone goes, okay, like, loser buys the beers, you know, for example, and it's just given that little bit more edge,
it does.
It's the international equivalent of like first to three, next goal wins.
I like that, though. I think it's worked well. I mean, and what's interesting about this Nations League is that I find the international teams I've been watching have picked up almost they've left off in the World Cup. So France, you know, groggy start, but looked good eventually. I mean, last night against Holland, and they were kind of sparring a bit with Germany, whereas Germany have been oddly flat, I think, again. They haven't really rejuvenated themselves.
Yeah, they were, I mean, I think the main thing for them against France was not to lose and to show that they, you know, they haven't lost some of their old spirit. And I guess they succeeded in that, actually. Against France, they were good. Defensively, they were strong. I mean, Joachim Löw demanded that they fight for every ball. And they were doing that. They didn't score, but neither did France. And I think to come out of that game without having lost is a step forward for them. But then a few days later, Germany played Peru and they win, but they're really not very good. I mean, they ended up needing a goal from their left back, Nico Schulz, who was playing his first game, and he kind of got them out of jail a little bit. So yeah, Germany are a strange one at the moment, and still very much a work in progress.
You were saying Peru could have won that game as well.
Yeah, I mean, Farfan had a great chance. I mean, he did everything. He got through the defence and just needed to put it one side of the keeper, Ter Stegen, who, by the way, made quite a bad mistake for Peru's goal early in the game. But Farfan missed and Germany won.
I mean, the thing about Peru is interesting. This, again, is a bit of a World Cup hangover for them, because what held them back, as I recall, was poor finishing. They had everything else, but the finishing touch. And one that strikes me is that very rarely do you have very rarely do you have small nations who have outstanding strikers who can take them through to the next level. That's why I think it was so incredible having Cameroon back in World Cup 90 with Roger Miller, because it was very rare that we had a player like that at the spearhead.
Absolutely. It makes such a difference, doesn't it? Yeah, we see that with a few international teams, actually. Aubameyang as well. And yeah, I mean, if you can have that, defensive bedrock, and just have one world-class striker who can bang them in, you can be a very effective international team.
That's why France won the World Cup. Olivier Giroud doing all the hard work for the bedrock of the rest of the team.
Can I say shout out to Giroud, like fantastic goal last night.
Yeah, it was amazing. Wasn't it? Yeah.
It was a beauty, yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny, classic Giroud though? He missed, I mean, Mbappe scored the first and arguably Giroud should have got to the cross first, but Mbappe got to the far post. And Giroud scored a blinder and he does that. He scores absolutely extraordinary like strikes.
I think we've mentioned it a few times on the show already, but he's a massively underrated finisher because he will tend to score the more difficult ones and miss the what looked like easier chances.
That doesn't make him underrated.
It makes him
highly frustrated.
Misunderstood.
It's funny because there was a player that played for Brazil in the 82 World Cup, Serginho. The nine, the kind of Giroud or the Givash type position, where you're slightly isolated from the action because you're the point man. So a lot of this stuff happens behind you. You're almost you're almost out on a limb. Mm. And you might argue, actually, to be charitable to Giroud, that part of his struggles up front, because you're so long out of the play, then all of a sudden it catches up with you. And then you're not in the same groove as the other strikers. They've seen the game in front of them. And you've got your back to goal or you're the point man. So very often those moves can come from, those misses can come, you can argue from just being actually out of the game for long periods. Mm. He's almost like he's so isolated up front. He's almost like a goalkeeper sometimes in terms of his isolation from the rest of his team.
And he's been playing in good teams, you know, so who often have a lot of the ball and play against, you know, deep line defences.
Right.
And we mentioned it, was it last week or the week before, about Lukaku kind of needing touches.
Yeah.
And how getting it, that helps getting in the rhythm. And I think the thing that Drew's so good at is the link play that he brings. And I think, you know, that's why he got a bit of a pass for not scoring through the World Cup, because he did so much work to bring other people into play.
Yeah.
That even without his goals, that what he gives you is a little bit overlooked, actually. And that's what I probably mean by underrated.
Well, I think Giroud be far harder to replace than people realize. There was a great piece that I think Squawker did on six different, Squawker website did on the six different permutations of France's front three. And it was funny because looking at the front threes they had, Giroud was the one player who I think was unique. You have Benzema who could be the head of a front three, but Benzema for personal reasons is not the best. But I actually think that, funnily enough, that system, I would think Giroud is better at leading the line in that specific context.
Yeah, he needs runners.
So I want to throw something in as well, just in relation to France, because I often forget this, but I absolutely love Blaise Matuidi. This is a guy that went from PSG to Juventus under a bit of a cloud. I think he didn't like the Neymar circus. And, you know, was someone we saw as a kind of defense midfielder, I suppose, primarily. Took a role, a self-sacrificial role, played as a sort of left-sided player with a defensive capability, but now is utterly rejuvenated. He looks like he's 22, 23 years old.
Mm.
You know, and he's 31, I think.
Yeah, he's such a team player.
I love seeing, you know, when you look at great teams, I always think, like, you know, to use an American expression, who are the glue guys? And Matuidi is absolutely a glue guy. You can imagine him, like, he's the guy to remember, like, do a birthday card for the team, or he'd be there, he'd turn up if you're like, you know, if you broke your leg, he'd be the first person in the hospital. He's that kind of guy, right? He's a glue guy, I think.
Yeah, he brings the oranges at halftime.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of love for Blaise Matuidi and or in or on this podcast.
Great guy.
In this room.
I just think that's, you know, maybe I'm an old man and sentimental, but, you know, the more I look at teams and how they're built, it's not just the headline acts. Mm. It's who's providing the glue. And, you know, Kante gets a lot of praise now, but I think people like Matuidi as well need a shout.
Did you guys see England versus Spain?
Oh, no, I didn't. Only I didn't see the game live.
It was a Thiago Alcantara masterclass.
Oh, what a
player. He was absolutely fantastic.
There's a midfield to do it against. I think that England midfield is...
Well, you raise a really, really good point. And I think that really is the thing stopping England from taking that big leap to being a world beater. really is the only thing.
Yeah, we covered in the World Cup podcast, didn't we? We said, I think, before the semi-finals or after the semi-finals, that lacking, England lacking a truly world-class central midfield, like ball-playing central midfielder.
Absolutely. And it was so clear watching that game that, you know, Spain have Thiago, they also have Isco. And if you look around the other teams in Europe, France have Pogba, Germany have Kroos and Gundogan.
Modric, Rakitic.
And Rakitic. I mean, that's probably the best around. England desperately lacked that. And I'm sorry to say that I just don't see them doing any better than they did. I think they absolutely outdid themselves in the World Cup, but I just don't think they can do any better with their current midfield.
And the problem is, I think it's a systemic thing, because you look at someone like Iarramendi, who came through the same generation as Thiago, is a terrific player. Didn't quite reach the heights as expected, but that is the kind of player that is produced by a coaching system. There is no coincidence that Spain have that depth in midfield. And somebody at St. George's Park, I'm sure, is thinking the final step to England getting where we can get is match control.
Yeah.
You look at Phil Foden, and Phil Foden is a player that absolutely can do that. And it'll be fascinating to see him at City. You know, I see actually...
So this is the Manchester City youngster.
Manchester City, young player. If you go on YouTube and you watch the highlights of the under-20 World Cup final, or under-19 World Cup final, where England beat Spain 5-2 in the final, I think Foden scores twice.
He was brilliant in that game,
That is, I mean, if you're looking at a ball-playing midfielder...
The thing is, though, he plays wider, and I think he would have to be converted to a central midfield.
I think he's like Bruno Silva. I think he can play the other route.
I don't want to bang the Arsenal drum, but I really think that someone like Ainsley Maitland-Niles is going to have a long England future. I think he, for me, looks like one of the most complete central midfielders that we've had at that age for a long, long time. He's very athletic, very, very tidy on the ball, very confident with the ball as well. Considering he's been kind of around that Arsenal first team for over a season, two seasons now. Mm. When he played last season a lot at left back or left wing back when he was stepping in, which isn't his position is centre midfield, he would often drop into central midfield positions and demand the ball off people. Very good at recycling the ball, keen eye for a pass, and he's got a lot of bite about him as well.
The thing I worry about, though, is that I've seen a bit of Maitland-Niles, he looks very good. Foden, I've seen quite a bit, he looks really, really good as well. But we're talking about your almost once in a generation quality of midfielder. Mm. And a player like Thiago doesn't come along very often.
No.
And it's so frustrating that England are so close but so far, you know.
I wish we had a visual element to the podcast then, because the anguish on Michael's face was was real. The pain is real.
I feel it.
Yeah, this isn't just quality analysis, guys. This is from the heart. Michael's hurting for a technical midfielder.
What I will say and what is really exciting for me is who these players are learning from. I absolutely love the fact that Maitland-Niles has been coached by Emery. You look at Foden learning from Guardiola. But I just feel like the next 3-4 years will be pivotal, because if these players like Foden, Maitland-Niles do well, that creates a pathway for other players like them. And also I think it affects the coaching dynamic further down the kind of league pyramid.
The one thing I do worry about in terms of from an England point of view, though, is what the plan is behind the scenes at a coaching level.
Yeah.
Because recently, especially since the St. George's Park construction and development and move, it seems that their process has been very reactive. Mm. It's kind of whatever the more successful nation in world football is doing. You know, there was a big kind of switch to the German idea or model. And I'm worried that by the time that those players who are receiving that approach come through, it's already too late. The game's moved. I really wonder if there is a plan looking forward in terms of developing their own method and their own kind of quote-unquote philosophies. Do you know what I mean? To bring these kind of young players through.
The FA could say, though, they could say in their defence, they won 3 world titles in a calendar year and no country's ever done that before. And those players are all young. You know, the generation, you could argue the generation we have now is the last generation that was well coached but actually not as talented, and the next 5 years will be a truer reflection of the success of what the FA has laid in place, because that generation is not only very well coached but exceptionally talented.
That's a really good point, actually.
And what's exciting as well, and to credit to the players, is that they themselves are being enterprising, because the FA can coach all they like, but it's the players who have to take the initiative of going abroad and playing for clubs abroad. I mean, Jadon Sancho going to Borussia Dortmund is just a wonderful, wonderful move. The bravery of that and the extent to which he's been rewarded by his desire to learn. So I don't know. I find myself excited by.
Yeah, I'd love to see more players follow Jadon Sancho's example, because, I mean, I went to Hertha Berlin versus Dortmund back in January when Sancho made his, I think that was his league debut. Certainly his first league start. And he was kind of, I would say, like a bag of tricks, you know, like a bit raw, definitely a raw talent who needs to learn. But you get, for every Jadon Sancho, there's another 10 of them in England who are not getting game time and not learning. You know, the path to success is not just being a bag of tricks, it's being able to play the game and understand it. And you only get that from experience. And I think Sancho has done, he's done such a good thing by going. He's still so young. I mean, he's, I think, similar age to Pulisic, and look what he's achieved at Dortmund. And whenever I see Sancho play for Dortmund, I think something's going to happen. And that's a great feeling. It's a great feeling to have. He's an exciting player.
And I think he's set such a nice example. You know, you see a lot of Brits, you know, a lot of us don't learn more than one language at school. So we're instinctively afraid of sort of going abroad and spreading our wings, and that's just the football. It's just any kind of Brit, any kind of British professional, and someone like him goes abroad, goes to a new city. 6 months later, people are like, "Oh, what's it like out there?" And he's like, "Actually, you know what? I made a completely new life," and that inspires people.
Yeah,
there's a great story. I don't know the guy's name now. I should have checked it before the podcast. But he's playing as a left back at Borussia Mönchengladbach. Mandela Egbo, that's it. Yeah. Mandela Egbo, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Plays for all the kind of reserves in front of 20,000 people a week, I think.
Yeah.
And has gone out there, made a really terrific life. And I think other people are seeing that and then catching on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as more English players make that kind of move, and I think the Bundesliga is a good league for it, because it's not as competitive as La Liga, for example, and you get more opportunities. So Reece Oxford is another young English player that's gone to Gladbach as well. So
Perfect club for youth talent.
Yeah, it really is.
In Germany, I would say.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting move, though. There's like Jonathan Panzo to Monaco. You know, like moves like this that are really interesting. Noni Maduke went to PSV. And he had Chris Willock went to Benfica B. Marcus McGuane left Arsenal last season, went to Barcelona.
Can I say this? It's really flattering when certain clubs come for you. I think I mentioned this on a podcast before, but, you know, when Thomas Lemar was being pursued by Atletico Madrid, you know that they have such a specific process. Like the way Monaco to come for you, you know, having signed Lucas Ocampo before and James Rodriguez, they know exactly what they're looking for. Technical, you make very good decisions on the break and transition. Like there's a footballing intellect. When a club like PSV comes for you with their heritage, or Benfica, you've got this incredible youth system. There must be a sort of sense of validation from that. And you don't get that playing for unnamed clubs in the Premier League and the Championship.
I mean, there's genuine European weight there in terms of history. You know, a club like Benfica and the history that it's steeped in. And
the only reason I want to mention the sort of football heritage side that we touched on there, imagine going from a reserve side, a Championship club, you know, or a Premier League club to Benfica. You're bumping into Rui Costa in the club canteen. Like, you know, that level of, do you see what I'm saying? Like, to go from a place of obscurity where all of a sudden you're kind of hanging out with the great and the good, and immersing yourself in a whole new culture must be a really valuable, really valuable asset.
The only thing I took from that was like, I wonder what they serve in the Benfica canteen.
Oh my goodness, can you imagine? Can you imagine?
So guys,
UEFA Nations League.
Yeah. Well, I was going to mention Brazil. Not part of the UEFA Nations League, of course, but they played USA in New Jersey, 2-0 to Brazil. Hardly any fans, though.
That's weird.
30,000, I think, in an 82,000 seat
stadium. Yeah, you'd expect
to
sell out there, wouldn't you? Brazil against the US?
Yeah, apparently the fans were priced out. $80 was the cheapest ticket, which is far too much when you've got a World Cup on the horizon and you're trying to encourage fans to get into the game.
It's just a friendly, right?
Just a friendly, but you've got Neymar, Firmino. I mean, you've got some of the biggest players in the world right there. And you want to see a full house.
I think Brazil have lost a bit of cachet, though. I think, you know, they are Brazil, they're brand Brazil, but I wonder if they've become a little bit complacent. And I don't mean the team as a whole. You know, I look at Neymar, for example, and there's that moment in that game, actually, the friendly, where Yedlin turns to Neymar, having fouled him, actually, and then the ref was like, you know, giving a free kick. And Legend says it two or three times, didn't you see the World Cup? Didn't see how Neymar died for the World Cup.
Really?
And that's how deep the rot has gone. Oh. Neymar went from being kind of like the adorable surfer boy, you know, the surfer prince of world football, the adorable kid who basically got, you know, that game against South Africa, the friendly, where the kid was idolizing Neymar and the security tried to get him off the pitch and Neymar put him on his shoulders and walked around and everyone loved him. And I was like, that was sort of peak Neymar.
Mm.
Champions League winner in his early 20s, playing with Messi and Suarez, all beautiful on the surface. And now, unfortunately, like, he's kind of lost his... It's like when Spider-Man lost his suit in Homecoming, it's like that. Like, it's the same thing.
Yeah, lost the love, really. There's no love for him anymore. And it happened, strangely, when he moved to PSG.
There's a game when he played against Nîmes, I think, recently. Was it Nîmes? They beat him 4-2. I think Mbappe got sent off. Mm. And Neymar scores a goal and gets booed. And does a sort of crybaby face to the crowd. And I was like, it's quite sad that Neymar's become a pantomime villain, actually.
Well, that was in front of a banner that said, Neymar, you're a crybaby.
Yeah, but
so
like...
So he went right in front of it.
But the fact that he's kind of... That wasn't a thing that Neymar was being called. It was the minority before that would give Neymar that. And it was more, you know, there was more a criticism of whether he was tough enough for the league, but there wasn't a sense that he was a petulant child.
Well, remember how he came to prominence as this kind of YouTube star, you know, like the typical like 21st century social media era story, you know, fans knew about him before we saw him in Europe. We all knew about him when he was in Brazil and some of the amazing things he was pulling off. And there was a genuine sense of excitement about what this guy could bring. And then he joined Barcelona and basically the whole world was always watching, you know, from when he was a teenager to, you know, when he finally made that move. Well, I remember there was a Club World Cup and he played against Barcelona.
It seemed to be that when he came to Barcelona, though, it was like, he's here. He's like, he's finally arrived.
Exactly.
It was like something that was been on the cards for ages. And that front three of Suarez, Neymar and Messi, it was like, you know, you kind of have those like old movies where there'll be like three brothers and two of them are kind of older and a little bit more like, you know, kind of streetwise. And there's the young one who's like, yeah, behave. And that was kind of what Neymar was like. But it was like, it seemed like there was a genuine, I don't want to say innocence, but it was this fun. Those three just clicked and they all genuinely seemed to love each other.
It was brilliant because we were all following Neymar's story like up until that point. And he finally linked up with Suarez and Messi and formed MSN, the most formidable forward line we've seen in Europe for who knows how long. And then for it all to be kind of almost thrown away seems so needless.
He wanted to do that solo album, man. And it was like he broke the band up.
And it flopped.
And it flopped. And now he's playing 300 capacity clubs where he could have been selling out arenas with the band, you know?
That is the perfect analogy. And I think what's funny about Neymar's, it's crazy talk of a decline, but a sideways move certainly, he's lost his aura. And
it's a backward move.
You look at PSG now, he went there to be the main man. He went there to be the main man, and now Mbappe is the main man at PSG.
Mm.
Mbappe is absolutely the main man.
Neymar's got what he deserved, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think he did. I think, you know, staying at Barcelona was absolutely the right thing from a football perspective. Mm. And he would have got all the glory he would have wanted. He would have got all the money. He would have made a better crossover to the US because Barcelona is a much bigger product, if we're being purely marketing about it. And I just wonder if there are people in the Neymar's marketing team who go, I think we got this one wrong.
Also, I wonder whether there was a level of impatience there about being the guy. Suarez isn't going to be at Barcelona for a hell of a lot longer. Could easily see Messi dropping deeper and deeper and playing until he's a little bit older, you know. But I wonder whether there was just a level of impatience there about being the guy now, as opposed to, you know, waiting 4 or 5 years and then eventually being the guy at Barcelona.
And that's no time to wait at all. Mm. When you're playing with the greatest who ever did it.
It just seems...
It's total impatience.
I mean, I when he moved to Barcelona, I admittedly didn't... I didn't think he would retire there.
Mm.
But I was surprised the move came as quick as possible, as quick as it did, you know.
What's interesting is there's now talk of Neymar going to Real Madrid at some point, which would just be the perfect circus. And I think those clubs are just ideal. That club, I can't think of a better marriage of club and player than Real Madrid and Neymar.
Yeah.
I just think if there's any place that, you know, Real Madrid is a circus, that there's always room for an extra.
He will end up there. And there's work going on behind the scenes to make that happen. I think that move is going to happen in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Should we take a quick break and then get into the rewinds?
Yeah, why not? Let's go for it.
Right, back from a break with a new feature. It's our first feature, I think. It's going to be a semi-regular thing that we'll do in some quietish weeks called Rabona Rewinds. Rewinds or Rewind?
Rewinds. Oh. Rewinds is quite nice.
No.
Rewinds with a Z. With an S. With an S. Keep it classy. So basically, the gist of this is that we each pick something that we love about football from the past. It could be a team. It could be a player. It could be a moment, a rivalry, a boot, a kit, anything you like, a stadium.
Yeah.
And then we basically just chat about it for a little bit.
Sounds perfect.
So welcome to the first edition of Rabona Rewind. We should have some theme music or something like that.
Yeah, we'll find some.
Musa, you're up. Who have you picked for the inaugural?
I have chosen the Brazilian Ronaldo, the phenomenon.
Oh, wow.
We have to take it there.
And that is the end of Rabona Rewind.
Everyone just sinks into a dreamlike state. Oh, the phenomenon. Look, the reason I mention him is because I don't think we will ever again see all the qualities of an elite centre-forward united in one human being. You know, the power of Batistuta, the finishing of Romario, the speed of Claudio Lopez, the presence of George Weah.
Mm.
You know, this guy was just...
And the touch of Redondo.
Oh, the touch of Fernando Redondo.
I'm going to have to open a window. It's getting steamy in here.
I'm sorry.
This talk.
It's a family podcast.
We have to put this one as explicit. This bug.
I just adore Ronaldo. Like, there are very few players in football history who have created danger within 50 yards from goal. Mm. And the second Ronaldo crossed the halfway line, nobody was safe.
What was your favourite Ronaldo goal?
This is the thing, it changes. It changes every sort of few months, and I actually find myself rewatching games of his. So for a long time, it was, I think, a goal against Valencia where two men basically tried to block him off and he just burst between them.
Mm.
There's the famous goal against Compostela, the 6-1 victory when he goes past, I think, five or six men.
That's my favourite Ronaldo goal of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it's peak, it's everything, isn't it? It's strength,
it's
speed.
The combination, it's touch. Raw Ronaldo, kind of early on the scene Ronaldo, but it's...
So this is for Barcelona?
Yeah.
Yes. Where he holds off a couple of defenders.
He gets the ball on the halfway line, first guy tries to pull his shirt off, and he holds him off, there's two around him, he does that little foot on top of the ball, stops, then goes past him.
Yeah.
All the way in the edge of the box, another drag back at the last minute, and then puts in the bottom left corner. But it's Bobby Robson's reaction when he comes off the bench and turns around and puts his hands on his head.
Yeah, like just astonished by what he's just saying.
It's the combination, I think, of the goal, the player, the moment, and Bobby being there.
Well, that was funny because that season you mentioned at Barcelona, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I got given a VHS tape, you know, back in the day. I got given a VHS tape, and it was that season.
Mm.
I think it scored 47 goals that season.
Wow.
And I think he was World Player of the Year after that. And I think he was, World Player of the Year 2 years in a row by the age of 21, which is obviously extraordinary. The youngest person to have gained the accolade twice. And I just remember thinking, there is no limit to his potential. There's no limit to how good he'll become.
Mm.
And he was somebody who enjoyed one-on-ones. I've never seen a striker so ruthless, so consistently ruthless. There's an amazing game. They play a friendly. Brazil play a friendly against Argentina. Either qualifier or Copa America, I'm not sure. But it was a serious match. It wasn't just a friendly. And Ronaldo earns three penalties and scores three penalties. And I've never seen that before. You can find it somewhere on YouTube. It's unbelievable.
I got up his goal record. 438 games, 291 goals, 41 assists, a goal every 118 minutes.
Unbelievable.
Mm.
For me, he was the first genuine superstar, like global football superstar I can remember of my lifetime. It seemed to be the first one who was just, like, you know, the nickname suggests, an absolute phenomenon.
He pretty much overlapped a little bit with Maradona, didn't he?
Yeah, but I think that Maradona was from a very different era as well. Well, he was from a very different era. And I think that Ronaldo, for me, really seemed to have that element of the modern day football superstar that we see now. Like, you know, Neymar, Ronaldo, Cristiano and stuff. But it was still that almost like prototype of the real, truly global.
The consistency as well. That's the thing, because until we have to look at the era that he was playing in, against some of the greatest defenders of all time, Lilian Thuram, peak Alessandro Nesta, and he would humiliate them.
Well, that's why one of my favourite Ronaldo goals, and there's so many to choose from, is at the moment anyway, the goal he scored in the final of the UEFA Cup. I can't remember which
Inter
year.
Inter against Lazio, was it 98?
It was,
I think it was his first year at Inter. So he'd left Barca, he'd gone to Inter, and I think it was his first year.
That sounds right.
1999, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and it was he just sold the goalkeeper, the most extravagant dummy.
Marchigiani, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah,
he actually sits down. The goalkeeper's actually.
He sits him down.
It sounds awful.
And he just, it was a step over, but it was also a shimmy, and it was just, it was
the end of a masterclass. Sorry to jump in. I'm remembering the footage in my head.
Yeah.
And that was the end of a game where he'd basically humiliated Alessandro Nesta.
Yeah. Who, by the way, was one of the biggest rising stars in Italy at that time.
There's a great story about that game. So Nesta said afterwards it was the worst experience of his football career. And he rewatched the performance several times to work out what he did wrong. And then he said, actually, I forgave myself because actually he was unstoppable.
And I forgot how good that Lazio side was.
Yeah.
Nesta, Negro, Favele, Diego Fuse was the captain, Jugovic, Nedved, Casiraghi, Mancini.
Oh my goodness.
No Signore.
Not then.
Signore probably had gone by then.
Earlier.
That era of Italian football was unbelievable.
It was. Sadly, that was kind of the back end of it, really. Back end of the great times.
Oh, can I say my favourite Ronaldo goal? I've got it now.
Another one.
This is the one. This is actually my favourite. This is
my new favourite.
It changes every 2 minutes. Interplay against Spartak Moscow in the Champions League, I think it was. And they're playing in the pitch is basically a mix of mud, salt, snow and ice. And Ronaldo gets the ball 35 yards from goal, accelerates to full speed within a couple of yards, plays a 1-2 with Zamorano, goes round the keeper and cracks it in the corner. Uh-huh. And it must be like, I mean, it must be almost sub-zero. It must be like very, very cold. And, you know, this whole thing about Brazilians can't play in cold conditions, whatever. And he shattered every single footballing stereotype in the space of like 15 seconds.
True.
He was amazing.
What I love about him is he's bigger than football on the pitch. He's football culture. If you look at the way that younger players look up to him, there's a great moment on Instagram. I think it was when Van Persie and Pires and some Arsenal players had him round for like dinner and Arteta was there and he's at the middle of the table and they're like kids. They're like kids at Christmas, like who actually got to meet Santa. Hey, like, you know, they found Santa eating the cookies and they joined him and they're sitting around him and they're just looking at him in awe. And you're like, you know, they call him the phenomenon because what he did, and this is where, you know, you can put Messi in the same category. There are things that astonish even fellow professionals who are only a couple of years younger. That's why I think he's, you know, over time, when we assess his legacy 50 years down the road, when everyone's done, they'll be like, no, he's right up there. Yeah, he's right up there. Yeah,
for sure.
The greatest number nine the world has ever seen, and I think ever will see.
Don't at him.
Don't at him.
Michael,
I've decided to pick out one of the greatest rivalries that I can remember, but it's not between two teams.
Ooh.
It's between two players.
Ooh.
Roy Keane versus Patrick Vieira.
Oh, yes. Big fan of that.
Punctuated by my childhood. I seem to, Arsenal and United at that time, of course, were the two dominant forces of English football. But you always knew there was going to be fireworks when those two came head to head and they hated each other. It was great.
I think that's my football, part of my favourite, one of my favourite moments in, or eras of football ever. I think that era of 98 to 2004, Arsenal, Manchester United, every game seems like the biggest game of the year.
I mean, I'm sure you guys remember when Vieira was picking a fight with Gary Neville in the tunnel.
Yes, that game of 4-2.
And
Arsenal Highbury.
Yeah, and Roy Keane told him, in no uncertain terms, let's say, to back off. And those two had the most ferocious rivalry, like just tackles flying in. I just loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Do you know what's funny about it? Just that it's how they were like, neither of them are English, but they completely embodied English football.
Absolutely. Mm.
Which is wild if you think about it.
Like, totally. Yeah, they were two of the early adopters of the... well, all kinds of skullduggery on the pitch.
Did you find that you people you knew had a favourite and it was like their flag was in the sand and they would like fight their corner?
Yeah, it was strange, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really, really was. Yeah. It's the same. I actually found it similar to the early debate between Van Nistelrooy and Henri.
I was in the Roy Keane camp though, just I don't know. Well, I mean, as a Spurs fan, I can't support Vieira under any circumstances. But there was something about Keane that I just like. I mean, they were both great players, and they were both so combative, and that was why they were so good. But Keane just had something about him. I think even Ferguson was scared of him.
I think they were the only players who were indispensable to those team's success. Mm. If Henri had never become Henri, Arsenal would have found the goals somewhere else. Not as many, but they would have found the goals. They would have found them through Reyes or someone. They would have found the goals. Mm. You know, if Scholes hadn't become that incredible deep-lying player, United would have found a way. They would have found a way. Keane and Vieira were indispensable. Without those players, those eras don't happen.
They were literally the heart of the team.
They were,
you know,
absolutely.
Positionally and kind of, you know, both being captains as well. It's a bit of a cliche to say, but they ran games.
These players embodied their teams. If you look at them, even culturally, you know, United having this very strong Irish support, working class support, and Keane was the kind of avatar of that.
Yeah.
And you look at Arsenal, they have this incredible cosmopolitan history. You know, they've always got a proud tradition of black players, but like, you know, North London's a very black area, you know, a lot of black people there. And you could look at Vieira and see North London in him, you know, because in North London, it's so integrated. You've got, you know, loads of white people and black people just mingle freely. So there was no challenge at all in seeing him as embodying. They both embodied the best of their local areas, which is something that's quite rare, I think, at this point in football.
Yeah. And it's interesting that both went into management or have gone into management, and Roy Keane, not very successful. Patrick Vieira is just starting off. So he can't really be judged, but I would have thought both of them would make great coaches, like just immediately.
Well, Keane's been a great number two for Ireland, actually. Yeah, got to give him credit for that. And he was very good at Sunderland. Ipswich, not so great. But there are elements of, you know, Keane maybe not a great manager, but I think he's a great coach, actually.
People respect him as well.
Absolutely.
Like, massively.
Because they fear him.
Yeah.
I think he's just a great number two, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that really worked, what he did with Ireland. The O'Neill Keane partnership is hilarious. There's a great moment where, you know, Ireland, they qualified some tournament, and at the end, Martin O'Neill is kind of like giving Keane a hug, and you can just, it's an amazing moment because O'Neill knows it's uncomfortable for Keane. I mean, the dynamics of that relationship are absolutely fascinating.
They strike me as a bit of a, you know, like an old cop duo.
Odd couple, yeah.
You know, it's like Keane's the angry genius.
Yeah, of course. It's true
detective. O'Neill's the guy that's like, lets all the clues just like completely slip past him, whereas Keane's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, for me, that summed up a whole kind of a decade of the best of the Premier League. And yeah, you look at how the game has evolved and how, you know, tackles are not really given the same, it's not seen as integral to the game anymore. And it's sad because I'd like to see another Keane and Vieira type rivalry emerge, but I don't think we're going to see anything like that.
I will just say that that's, again, it's cyclical, because don't forget we had, you know, that sort of tough tackling era, Catenaccio, Helenio Herrera, you know, 60s, that followed the Madrid period of free football, you know, free-flowing, free-loving football. And so these things go in cycles.
But the game is moving towards less and less contact.
I don't know, because we always say this. We always say stuff is moving away from something, then it comes back to it. Like we said that Barcelona was the end of history, you know, 4-3-3 was the way forward. And then they get destroyed 7-0 by Bayern in the semis, playing this very hard, physical, brutal you know, counterattacking style.
But that's, for me, always, that physical side of the game is always, was always there until relatively recently. I don't see it dipping in and out.
Mm.
I see it as just a gradual decline.
Maybe there is a halfway house between, you know, the high athleticism we're seeing and the kind of a, more of a physical approach. The clubs that are the best are the ones that have that kind of edge to them. And even, you know, mentioning Maitland-Niles, you know, as a player that has got the ability to kind of like assert himself physically. And Oxlade-Chamberlain as well. That to me is the kind of the modern midfielder. Somebody who is physically robust, or Naby Keita, for example. He's a guy who is a great example of that, I think, that trend.
Yeah. Yeah, used in the right way, it can still be effective.
Yeah.
I think it's just physicality in a different way, though, now. You know, I mean, back that Keane Vieira rivalry era was, seemed to be like a real sweet spot for where the game was moving in a very, a much more technical direction. It was speeding up in the Premier League. And then, but those two guys still had it all, you know, like they could kick the whatever out of each other, and they were tough, tough, tough guys. It was a really, really sweet kind of like, almost like, I don't want to use the word perfect, but it was almost perfect. It was like a perfect combination of style and aggression and physicality and, you know, a genuine rivalry between people who absolutely hated each other.
It was the Premier League's sweet spot,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I think it was perfect. I mean, there's one performance I always talk about from Arsenal, and you can find it online. Arsenal beat West Ham 4-0, and I think it was 4-0 at half-time. And Overmars was speed skating. And Sir Alex Ferguson must have looked at this and been like, I'm in trouble here. We've got a challenge here. Because that Arsenal team, I mean, I watched that game and I remember thinking, this is science fiction. Like, this is not, this, I've never seen football played that speed and that precision until Arsenal did it like that in that game against West Ham.
I think that's why the rivalry escalated so quickly and got so personal, because Sir Alex had, he kind of had the run of the Premier League, really. And there was a guy who a lot of people didn't know about coming in. And everyone who's close to Ferguson says, you know, he only gets that nasty about people that he really fears.
Right.
And you could see that when Arsenal went into the period when they moved to the new stadium and they weren't competing for the title anymore, Ferguson adored Wenger, and he adores him now, and they adore each other.
Yeah.
And I think that underneath that real bitterness and nastiness between them, not that this is about Wenger and Ferguson, it's about Keane and Vieira, but obviously an extension of that, there was more of a, this guy's good, I have to beat this guy. Mm. He's so good, I have to beat him.
That's what made Ferguson the best coach ever, that he was able to absorb the challenge of Wenger first and see what he was doing and eventually find a way to beat it. And if it wasn't Wenger, it was Mourinho, and, you know, various coaches that tried but couldn't.
There's a point to make here about how I think Keane and Vieira were the perfect embodiment of their managers on the pitch. And at clubs where you don't have that, the team doesn't work. So if you look at Diego Simeone, Atletico, you had Gabi. Gabi was Simeone. Gabi had been through all this difficult time, had struggled to assert himself. But, you know, he was the soul of the club on the pitch. And I think the reason why Keane and Vieira are so incredible is Keane was perfectly aligned with the city of Manchester and was perfectly aligned with Ferguson in terms of desire to win. Vieira had that same, you know, being had the urbane side, but had a tough side. And Wenger had a dark side as well. So I think that if we look at clubs that can be successful, those things need to be aligned. The manager needs to be aligned with the captain, and the captain with the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a rivalry.
Yeah, it was great. And perhaps the like we'll never see of again.
All right, my turn.
So yeah, what have you got for us, Ryan?
Well, you know, after those two heavyweights, could only chuck in another heavyweight, which is the Ajax 1995 Champions League winning team.
What a
team.
Oh, that's strong.
What a team.
That's strong.
Musa looks like he needs to have a little lie down after hearing those words in that order.
It's emotional, I'm sorry.
So I remember a few of the names, of course, that golden generation that came through together, but
yeah,
what was the 11?
Well, I'm going to introduce it and give it a little bit of context.
Yeah.
So basically, Ajax hadn't won a Champions League or a European Cup since that, when was it?
They won three straight in a row.
AC Milan were trying to break Real Madrid's record and be the side that had won the most European Cups. There was a lot riding on this.
Yeah.
AC Milan's lineup was Sebastiano Rossi, Panucci, Maldini, Albertini, Costa Curta, Baresi, Donadoni, Desai, Mazzaro, Boban, and Marco Simeone.
There is no weak link in that team.
Oh my God. And they were the defending champions, weren't they?
Uh-huh.
Were they coached by Capello?
They were.
Yeah.
On the bench, they also had Stefano Ariano and Lentini.
Lentini, who... Was he still the most expensive player of all time at that point? I'm not sure. Sorry. I think he moved in 93. I don't know if he still was the most expensive in 95.
I mean, Milan were overwhelming favourites, right, I think, for that game.
Well, it was difficult because it's a tough one because they were pretty stacked, obviously.
Yeah.
They'd won the year before. They destroyed Barca. And that was a surprise, that win. They'd ground it out. But I think you're right. By 95, they were not expected to take it, even though Ajax had been brilliant.
Mm. And then the Ajax lineup: Edwin van der Sar, Michael Reisiger, Danny Blind, Frank Rijkaard, Frank de Boer, Clarence Seedorf, Vanidi George, Edgar Davids, Ronald de Boer, Jari Littman, and Mark Overmars, with this bench: Winston Bogard, Kanu,
goodness me,
Patrick Kluivert, and Peter van Vossen, coached by Louis van Gaal.
Yeah, it was so many of those players you've just read out. You know, Clarence Seedorf, for example, went on to win the Champions League with three different clubs. Still the only player to have achieved that. But this was really the starting point for many, many careers.
I can remember watching the final, and I can remember almost everyone rooting for Ajax.
Yeah.
This might be a bit of a revisionist, but there seemed to be real joy when they won. They were a really young team. They played amazing football. I remember talking to my dad about this because he remembers peak Ajax, and I think that a lot of that generation were so pleased that Ajax were kind of there again. And you know, obviously they've not won since, and are a very different club now, but.
And also at that time, AC Milan were the ambassadors, you know, of European football. As you just said, they came off the back of that massive 4-0 win the previous year. But the football wasn't that entertaining, really. As we've come to expect from Fabio Capello, it was effective, very effective, but defensively minded.
Mm.
And Ajax were a breath of fresh air. They were, you know, a young team, cosmopolitan team, made up of various different nationalities as well.
Well, actually, I mean, you say that, but I mean, this was still back in an era when both teams only had two foreigners starting the games.
Oh, really?
The only two foreigners...
Vanidi George was Nigerian, of
course. Yari Littman was and still is Finnish.
Yeah.
So those were the only two non-Dutch players that started for Ajax, and Desai and Boban were the only two non-Italians that started.
But there was a sense of excitement about Ajax that we didn't have for Milan. And the one thing that I think of when I think of that Ajax's run to the final was Vanidi George's winning goal in the semi-final. Well, it wasn't really a winning goal. I think they battered Bayern in the end.
Five-two. Yeah.
But it was an absolutely stunning goal. I mean, Overmars cut back from the left, rolled the ball across, and Littmanen did a great dummy, which just sold half of the defence, and Vanidi George just didn't break stride and just outside of the foot, just or kind of cut across the ball, and it just swerved into the top corner. It was a fantastic goal.
I want to touch on just like, I mean, that team broke up pretty shortly after that, and they all went on to do amazing.
Mm.
They all went on to be pretty good footballers, a lot of that team.
Wow, nearly all of them.
Well, yeah, I was kind of being a little bit sarcastic, but okay. One move I want to talk, because I know that this is something that you and me have spoken about a lot, Musa, is Seedorf.
Yes.
Seedorf made a really interesting move after this because he had offers from everyone, right?
Yeah.
And he just won the Champions League and he moved to Sampdoria, which was, we've spoke about this, you think it's like one of the most power moves of...
I think it was absolutely brilliant. Like, it was... Seedorf went to Sampdoria because he wanted to play. He was like, you know, I've won a Champions League, but he humbled himself and he was like, if I go to Barca or AC like the others have done, I think roughly half went to Barca, half went to AC. Kluivert went to Milan, had a miserable time. Seedorf went to Sampdoria and played, I think, 30-odd games. And then there's a great story at the end of that season I think the last game of the season, Sampdoria played Milan, and Christian Karamba and Seedorf bumped into Capello in the tunnel afterwards, and he was like, Capello was like, by the way, I've got the Madrid job. Do you want to come with me to Spain? And they're like, yeah. Like, it was basically just done there and then. They agreed to it in the tunnel, and Seedorf moves there to Madrid and, of course, wins the Champions League a year later. Wins the league title that year, then wins Champions League a year later.
Mm. Yeah, just a really interesting move. One year really in Sampdoria, cerebral. And then back to Real Madrid.
Mm.
But yeah, that was good times. Good times.
I love that you mentioned that, because that team, if you look at the football intelligence, it's like a Cambridge University. Like, either those team, you look at that forward line, all of those players, Ronald de Boer, Litmanen, Overmars, they could begin and end counterattacks. It is very rare you get a forward line where everyone is a playmaker, you know, a primary playmaker, where you could run, you could say to Ronald de Boer, run the attack, Patrick Kluivert, run the attack, set up the counterattack. That is almost unheard of in world football, like at any level. And all those players, you know, like someone like Seedorf, who adapted to three completely different tactical systems in his career, you know, played in a 3-4-3, 4-3-3, played in a 3-5-2, could just do any kind of configuration. Can I also throw something as well in? Like, there's a certain type of player in world football who they kind of loosen the screws before the door falls off. And at the Champions League final, that's what Kanu did. Like, obviously, Kluivert scored, but there's a great quote from Kanu where he says, I came on against Milan. I think he came on as a late sub. And he was just like, you know, at first I was a bit nervous, but then I went up against Baresi and I became a man. And it's, you know, loosening the screws, kind of creating gaps. If you see the way the goal was scored, you know, the surging run, I think, from Rijkaard and plays into the feet of Kluivert. And it's this kind of thing where you're like, Kanu just like popping up a little sprite, kind of like going, okay, look, here's a pressure point. Let me create space here, create space there.
It's worth noting as well that he was 18 in that final.
Unbelievable. I mean, what a player.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a really, yeah, I've got very fond memories of that side. And one, you know, to kind of wrap that up, one thing that really saddens me in a way that neither of these teams are still, at the moment, European powerhouses.
Right.
You know, I would love to still see Ajax and AC Milan consistently competing for the Champions League. It's a real shame. Not to end this on a sad note, but I really, you know, when you say AC Milan and Ajax, to a whole new generation of young football fans, they may not have the same weight that they did for us lot growing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, kind of don't want to be like, get off my lawn.
No,
but think, you know, it's something I really miss, you know?
I think, though, if we can be, you know, it's nothing wrong with ending on a bittersweet note, but also, you know, all these great clubs have had periods of remission. Bayern Munich had their wilderness years, you know? So there's no reason why Ajax can't come again. With the right coaching setup and the right infusion of talent, 5-6 years from now, there's no reason why they can't return.
Yeah, I mean, even Real Madrid hadn't won a Champions League since 2002 before they went on their run of dominance. So,
and before that win in 98, they hadn't won in 30-something years. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure as ever to talk to you.
Likewise.
I hope you enjoyed Ribona Rewinds. Our listeners, thank you so much again for joining us. You can find us on social media, same handle across all platforms, at Ribona Mag. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.